Looking at the Documents of Our Freedom, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Great to be with you, Barry, and I'm glad to be able to start out today reading the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence in Congress, July 4th, 1776. The unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government, and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies. And such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world.
He has refused to assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good.
He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them.
He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless these people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them, and formidable to tyrants only.
He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records, for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures.
He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasion on the rights of the people.
He has refused for a long time, after such dissolutions, to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within.
He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migration hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands.
He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers.
He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount of payment of their salaries.
He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures.
He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power.
He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation.
For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us.
For protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states.
For cutting off our trade with all parts of the world.
For imposing taxes on us without our consent.
For depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury.
For transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses.
For abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies.
For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments.
For suspending our own legislatures, and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever.
He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us.
He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people.
He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation.
He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands.
He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions.
In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people.
Nor have we been wanting in attention to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends.
We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress, assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
G. Barry, the religious nature of this is simply undeniable.
Oh, absolutely.
How many references to the Creator exist in the Declaration of Independence?
At least four.
At least. The Creator, the judge of this world.
Supreme judge.
Yeah.
The divine providence. You name it. It just keeps going on and on and on.
Say what you will about Thomas Jefferson. And I was a little disappointed by David Barton. I have a copy of his book, the book on the Jefferson myth. And I'm a little disappointed in that book in that he does really attempt to make it look like Thomas Jefferson was an Orthodox Christian, which he was not. However, One has to remember that the Declaration of Independence was drafted by Jefferson. It was edited by a committee.
Yes, it was.
Which Jefferson, to his dying day, was not happy with. The fact is, he liked the original draft better than he liked the edited version, and he carried the original draft around with him and would very happily bring it out and show people and say, now see, isn't this one better? Well, I've seen the original. No, it's not better.
No. And actually, I believe that the committee that worked on the, shall we say, improvements to the draft were men who were of Orthodox Christian belief, by and large. I think,
At
least maybe with the exception of Franklin.
Yes. And even Franklin is a real tough fish to nail down. He's really hard to deal with because as he grew older, he became more Orthodox, which is strange.
It wasn't really strange. He was very much impressed by and under the influence of a certain Anglican preacher by the name of George Whitefield.
Oh, well, that's true.
Whose open-air preaching in among the colonies, Franklin went to every time he had an opportunity and usually ended up leaving with his pockets much lighter as a donation to Whitefield's ministry.
On several different occasions, I've had some people bring to me, attempt to show me that Franklin was an atheist by something that was written in his autobiography, which I also have read and have a copy of. And I could tell that these people had cut and paste them from atheist websites because I said, this is really interesting because you completely left off the next four pages wherein Franklin says that, yes, he talked his friends into becoming atheists and he was so appalled by the behavior that came out of them after he regretted it deeply and abandoned the idea of atheism from that point on.
Yeah, that's slightly inconvenient to contextualize
yes.
things that they're trying to use to make their point.
Well, let's talk about some of the men who were on the committee. John Adams,
yes.
We've already said Benjamin Franklin, who was clearly not Orthodox, probably a Unitarian, and Jefferson himself was probably a Unitarian. Adams, at that point, was still a Calvinist. Later on life, he abandoned Calvinism and became a little more... He followed the wave and became Unitarian. That was the wave at the time, was Unitarianism. Roger Sherman and Livingston.
Yes,
Robert Livingston. And both of those men were Orthodox Christians. So we had three Orthodox Christians, one guy with a foot in both camps, and Jefferson, a committed Unitarian, and had been for some time.
Yes.
He was an Enlightenment man. But, however, you can still see that even as a Unitarian, he had a deep reliance on the Creator God. Now, of course, since he denied the fact of the Trinity, it wasn't the same God necessarily that you and I would worship. However, nonetheless, it was at its base, he was the God of the Bible. So,
absolutely.
This is a very important document. It shows that the Puritan influence was still there because if you read the tenets in here, you can see the stair-step function of the Mayflower Compact and the Plymouth Agreement and then the Declaration of Independence.
Absolutely.
It's all there. And just remember that Jefferson and Franklin both, despite the fact that they were not necessarily Orthodox believers, they had a Christian worldview. In other words, they were raised and inculcated with the Christian faith. They were raised and inculcated by men who had that faith, and therefore that came out in their thought. Jefferson couldn't help but have these ideas, going back to the Creator, because he was raised by men like George Wythe.
That's right.
He studied at the feet of George Wythe. He was great friends with George Mason, who was a very pious Orthodox believer.
And I'm glad you brought up George Mason, who, by the way, happens to be my favorite founding father, because it was George Mason's authorship of another document
That's right.
that Jefferson drew heavily from in his ideas for drafting the Declaration of Independence. And that was a little document called the Virginia Declaration of Rights.
Can you say plagiarized?
Well, I could say that, but I was trying to be kind to those who are departed. But George Mason, who was a believer, who was Orthodox, and who understood the sovereignty of God, and who not only in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, but even in cases that he argued as an attorney, recognized that we are answerable to God for all things. And so those ideas about endowed by our Creator and divine providence and the supreme judge of the world are straight out of George Mason. And so we have a legacy of Christian faith in the political documents of our country from the moment the first permanent settlement actually stepped foot on Plymouth Bay.
And we give thanks to Almighty God for it.
Amen.
And with that, we are out of time. Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.